The Time Magazine, who was the pool reporter who flew up with the Exxon.
I don't know about the four sensitive areas. It took us to
is now
over the boat, down to Naked Island, and then over Naked Island down at night. And then they turned around and brought us back. There were booming off areas, you know, areas of oil, and they were also skimming up oil, some with small skim boats, some with larger skim barges that were being towed by large boats.
Well, Paul, what's the estimated size of the slate now? Do you know?
Don't know the answer to that. I mean, I have no clue. But it seemed to me absolutely vast. Yeah, immense.
Paul, did you see anybody on beaches cleaning up?
Nobody. We saw no one on beaches. So nobody on the ground at all.
Hal,
I don't know if there were clearly fishing boats out there involved in booming operations, but there were also a couple large barges that clearly weren't fishing boats, and I assume that Exxon brought those in. Nobody on the beaches that I could see. We did not go all the way south. We went as far as Herring Bay on Night Island, and that's about, you know, rough reckoning, maybe 42 miles.
What'd you see in Herring Bay?
A lot of oil. And maybe a dozen ships, mostly fishing boats, working to boom the oil and contain it. And then there were some skim boats that were, you know, that they were using to come over to the areas where they had boomed to scoop up the oil.
Any sign of herring?
Of what?
Herring?
Not from about 2,000 feet. Also, if anybody knows Craig Fuji, tell him I've got his camera.
We just heard from the Time Magazine reporter who was the one selected to take up Don Cornette's offer to fly over the area of the oil spill today to try to spot the skimmers and confirm the number of skimmers that were in service. And what he said was that what he saw would tend to confirm the claims that Exxon was making about how many vessels were in fact in use or skimmers that were in service. He did say, however, they saw no one working on the beaches, on the shore, on the cleanup. This is a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center. This is the evening Exxon briefing on the ongoing status of the grounded Exxon Valdez and the oil spill that resulted from the damage to the vessel. Good Friday, 6 days ago. The Don Cornette, the spokesman for Exxon, is here. We don't see Frank Arossi, who has the president of Exxon Shipping, who has been carrying the brunt of these press conferences. No, yes, he is here now. I see him. He has come in. There are two other gentlemen on the platform who I don't know. I assume we'll be introduced to them as the press conference progresses. The conference should give us an indication of what activities have been undertaken by Exxon today and what their plans are tomorrow. Here is Don Cornette.
I have a couple of announcements that I would like to make right off, and then also to tell you that we have with us tonight the president of Exxon USA, Mr. Bill Stevens, to my right, and next to him is Pete Lethard, the president of VECO, who is the gentleman who is managing all the hiring, and then, of course, Mr. Iarossi. The order that we plan to do this is we have Mr. Stevens make a statement. Mr. Iarossi then will bring you up to date on his activities, and then I will come back up and we'll pick up where we left off this morning. The announcements that I wish to make are that some people are taking advantage of this situation. We have a couple of people going around posing as Exxon managers, opening accounts in stores, proposing to hire people and telling them no purchase order is necessary. And it's for the business people that this announcement is made. You stand to risk to lose financially if you don't make certain. Now, there are a lot of cases where someone from Exxon comes to you and wants you to do something right away, and that's legitimate. Excuse me, but just be sure that it is an Exxon person, because there are people who are playing games. I think that was the announcement I wanted to make. Now we'll hear from Mr. Stevens.
Well, this is my first opportunity to be on the ground here in Alaska since this unfortunate incident occurred. And let me begin by saying how deeply we in Exxon regret the unfortunate incident. And I would hope that the actions of the Exxon people here on the ground since last Friday would speak much more firmly about the strength of that view than my simple words just did. Let me say it was with the understanding that events had turned against us from a weather standpoint late Sunday and Monday. When I got that report on Tuesday morning, that I concluded I should get myself to Alaska. I felt I should come for a couple of reasons. One, to lend my support to the Exxon team that's already on the scene. And secondly, as appropriate and needed, to consult with the key state and federal officials. And I was glad today to have an opportunity to have a fairly extensive visit with the mayor of Valdez as well. Let me emphasize one reason that I'm not here. I didn't come to Alaska to in any way take over Exxon's responsibilities or role in the operation that is underway. From the very first instant, we sent our best management and technical people in oil spill containment and control cleanup to Alaska. And I'm told that currently we have over 150 Exxon people, and that includes our technical consultants on the scene. That's not total hiring. That's direct Exxon people helping manage the situation. I've kept in close touch with events here in Alaska since early last Friday morning, Houston time, meeting over the holiday period each day to ensure that all of the resources of the Exxon Corporation worldwide have been brought to bear to minimize the problem. I should also add that we have sought and received excellent cooperation from the oil spill response organizations on the West Coast, on the Gulf Coast, in the Caribbean, and in fact from as far away as England and as close as Canada as well. Through my departure from Houston yesterday morning, we've continued to marshal men, equipment, and expertise, and I'm sure as you'll hear in a moment, they're continuing to arrive on the scene. At this point, the regional response team, which as you know consists of Exxon, federal, and state officials, is functioning well, and I have no feeling it would be productive for me, nor do I in any way desire to get directly involved in this operation. However, we in Exxon, those of us in Houston who had been deeply involved and also touched by the event, felt that we must take whatever steps possible to help, and that's why I've come along at this point. Simply put, my view was that I had done all I could in Houston, and I wanted to be here to ensure that any other constructive steps that we might take would be taken. And on that point, I should say that I visited today with Secretary of Transportation Skinner, EPA Administrator Riley, and the Commandant of the Coast Guard, Yost, and participated with Frank in a full briefing on the status situation with that group. Again, let me make one broad comment beyond the current event. However unfortunate this event is, I think it's important to this country that we look beyond this incident at the broader national interest with respect to development of the energy resources that we in this country need to continue to develop our standard of living. And in that context, without in any way intending to diminish the tragedy, if you will, of this spill, I want to just observe for you that over the, I guess, 12 or so years of operation of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, I'm told that there have been some 8,700, something over 8,700 tanker loadings at Valdez. And those ships have transported some 6.6 billion barrels of oil during this time. And the cumulative amount of oil spilled until this incident from all of those loadings and all of that oil being moved, it's about 5,000 barrels, and that includes spills in the terminal as well as spills from vessels. I think that puts the industry's record in proper context. Again, certainly a dramatic incident of this magnitude raises some questions that we'll be looking at in terms of the appropriateness of our response. On the other hand, I think the industry's record broadly, I think my company's record on environmental matters is good. I think it has been improving, and I don't feel that one incident, dramatic though it may be and unfortunate though it may be, really is the proper perspective for viewing the industry's record generally. With that, I'll turn it over to Frank.
As of today, the Exxon response team had grown to 160 members. And again, what I'm defining is those people who are managing, supervising, or advising all of the operations going on out of our center. We have an additional 350 to 400 people in work crews and boat crews, so we've got a total of about 500 to 550 people now engaged in different activities. Just to give you some ideas of the magnitude of the operation, we've had 37 cargo plane loads coming in with equipment and material. I just made one check last night before I turned in. We had 30 tons of equipment on the ground in Anchorage. It was being reloaded onto smaller planes and trucks by two Exxon expediters out there. A lot of the equipment that is coming in is now shifting to beach cleanup type of equipment. We still have the two dispersion spray aircraft out at Anchorage, and we've got 110,000 gallons of dispersant, and we're holding that in reserve because we have to remember that we still have 550,000 barrels of oil in that damaged tanker. I think we've lost the opportunity to do anything with regard to dispersant on the original 240,000 barrels, but we still need to keep those planes and dispersants on hand just to make sure that the part of the cargo that we have not recovered yet that's in the tanker, until we get that safely offloaded, we still have a significant danger there. We've got approximately 30,000 feet of 18-inch boom deployed. We've got another 20,000 feet of sorbent boom available for when we get into the beach cleanup operation. Most of our boom is deployed in a defensive mechanism around four particular sites of the highest environmental sensitivity, fish hatcheries and natural areas. We're running a moderate-sized airline operation ourselves. We've got 10 helicopters and 4 fixed-wing aircraft under Exxon control out at the Valdez Airport. We already have 180 flights under our belt. We have 6 smaller skimmers that will be used when we begin the cleanup, and we've got another 8 to 10 coming. And these are not the open water skimmers, but the skimmers we'll be using in part of the actual beach cleanup once we get that underway. Just about every boat that we have in the area has been mobilized. The count I had this morning, and I have not had a chance to update it, but as of about noon, we had 26 fishing boats, 8 tugs or utility-type vessels, and 2 large barges in our flotilla. What we're doing, what we have done, and we're still in the process of doing, we need to organize all of this floating operation into 2 flotillas around motherships, so that we can provide a resupply of equipment, so that we can refuel them, and so that we can provide food to them. We have all these people out on the water, some 40 to 80 miles away from here, and we need to move an entire supply, resupply operation out that way, and we're in the process of doing that. One of our concerns is that we've got a lot of people that have been in the field for a long time, and we're having to plead with them to break off and get some rest. We try to encourage, beat some people into submission to break off for a few hours, and they basically said, no way, every barrel we get up is one less on a beach. That's the kind of thing that's been going on all the time. But we do need to worry about people just getting exhausted. So we're going through a very methodical rest period for them. The operation that's going on around Night Island is going to go on for a long time. So we need to get it into a much orderly routine. Routine is the wrong word. Nothing can be described as routine. We need to get it in a much more orderly, ongoing approach, because it's going to be a long time. We can't keep people going 22 hours a day, which is just about the way it's been up to now. So we need to begin to approach this in a more sustainable fashion, because we're going to have to sustain it. And that's kind of the transition we're getting into. We ourselves have outgrown our operations center. We are in the process of leasing an office building here in Valdez, and we'll be moving all of our activities to that. I understand Mr. Stevens has leased a house for me. Let me talk a little bit about the operations at the ship itself. As of 6 p.m., we had transferred 450,000 barrels off of the stricken tanker. That's just about 45%. We've got 7 pumps in operation. We're at a transfer rate of about 8,000 barrels an hour average. We've got an additional 4 pumps, so a total of 11 that are on board the damaged vessel. We'll be hooking those up. We'll be finishing the first offloading operation by about 10 p.m. tonight. That's from the Exxon Valdez into the Exxon Baton Rouge. And at that point, the Baton Rouge should have about 480,000 barrels offlifted from the damaged vessel. The vessel should disengage about 10:30 p.m. tonight. We have 2 diving crews out on the site, because we have to do some additional underwater survey, particularly alongside the port side of the vessel. That's the side that the 2 vessels were moored to during transfer, and the divers weren't able to get along the port side during that time. So we're going to take a couple hours out to complete the survey, so that we can get a full and much more detailed understanding of both the damage to the underwater body and also the position that the vessel is resting in. That part of the operation has gone very well. I know it's not spectacular, the ship just sits there, but I can't emphasize more the concern we have had from the beginning that we had a 240,000 barrel problem, and the last thing in the world we could stand is having a 1,240,000 barrel problem. So we've just been going all out to keep this this situation from getting any worse than it is. And we feel very confident, very successful up to this point. So we've got about half the cargo off. We've got another half to go. We'll be moving the Exxon San Francisco alongside the damaged vessel about 6 in the morning. And by 8, we should be transferring cargo. We hope to have all the pumps in operation at that point and have a transfer rate of about 10,000 to 12,000 barrels an hour. We think the second operation will go much faster, and we're anticipating that the transfer to the San Francisco will be complete late Friday night, early Saturday morning. We may still have some cargo remaining on board, so we have a third vessel that arrived or will arrive tomorrow morning. It is the Exxon Baytown. It's a smaller vessel and about a 58,000 tonner, and she'll take off any remaining cargo and as much oily water mixture as we can. And that should be, you know, through the weekend. At that point, we'll be ready to begin our salvage operations. We hope to have all the cargo off the vessel at that time, but we'll still have an oily water mixture in those damaged tanks. And we'll be employing a procedure in which we seal off all of the deck penetrations and basically make those tanks airtight. And we've already started that process on the vessel. Once we have a total air seal on the vessel, we will introduce first inert gas using the inert gas, the ship's inert gas system, into the vessel. That'll be followed by compressed air, and essentially we will create an air bubble inside those tanks, and we expect that vessel to float free. That's all I have at this point as an update.
Let me just finish up.
Don will say a little bit more, and I'll come back.
The other announcement that I had that I forgot, and that this is important, there was an unauthorized call issued today from someone in the legislature that went out over statewide radio that said that Exxon was looking for 1,000 employees, and it's created a little bit of havoc in the job services across the state. We're trying to be a little bit more orderly than that, but I was asked by the governor's office to please clarify that. We did not authorize a statewide call for 1,000 employees. We are trying to put the people on as we need them. At this point, we probably have more people on the payroll than we can effectively work, but I would rather be in that position than have fewer people than I have worked for. But we're kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't. We've put we've answered a lot of questions about why some people yesterday didn't do some work, and I checked into the best information that I could get on the Glacier Queen was that a crew was taken out and they didn't do much and they came back. Now that's not efficient, but we're a little over prepared in that area. I'd rather be that than be short. Dr. Ronald Goodman, a remote sensing expert, has conducted 3 flyovers since Tuesday to assist in tracking the oil. The total area of the spill will be calculated from this data. The information has been used to determine boom deployment areas and to survey environmentally sensitive areas. No dispersants were applied today. Attempts to burn at Eleanor Island yesterday were unsuccessful. The oil was too heavily emulsified to ignite. We will continue to try to use burning, however. Tidal zone cleanup, which includes both skimming and beach cleaning near the shore, is expected to focus on Naked, Eleanor, Ingot, Knight, and Bly Islands. Efforts now are directed toward additional skimming in these areas prior to beginning the physical cleanup activities. We now have single sideband radio telephone to communicate with fishing boats that are working on the spill. And just to Frank said he didn't have an update on that. The number that I got just before I came up here was that we have 40 vessels that are out there 24 hours, and we have 8 vessels shuttling people back and forth. The single sideband radio telephone will be manned 24 hours a day. As of Wednesday morning, no oiled birds have been treated at the bird cleaning center established in Valdez. Dr. Alice Berkner of the International Bird Rescue Center is heading this effort, and a coordinated survey effort between aircraft and surface vessels is expected to be conducted tomorrow. The first mammal survey was recently conducted by Dr. Randall Davis, and no oiled mammals were found. A second survey boat was dispatched this afternoon, and I don't have the results of that. We have a claims office operational in Valdez, and we are attempting to open one in Cordova just as fast as possible. The Valdez telephone number for claims is 835-5046. We will be publishing this in the newspaper and running it on the television so that people will know if they have a claim or they suspect that they're going to have a claim, that they have a place to call. And the only other piece of business that I would like to do before we take your questions is to, I missed the part of the report that the gentleman from Time Magazine gave, and I would just ask you if there are remaining questions about that, but first tell you that what I am attempting to do is give you timely information. There's a trade-off between timeliness and precision. If it's precision that you demand, I'm going to have to take more time in preparing the data and wordsmithing the reports, and I can't just grab them out of the typewriter and run up the hill and read them to you. It's up to you, but I hope the report that you got indicated that I was giving you the best information that I could give you. Now we will take your questions. The oil is not moving into the beach area as fast as we thought it was, but that has moved in, is there's still a lot of free oil. There is oil on the beach, but we are concentrating on trying to skim the free oil and keep it off the beach. To my knowledge, nobody is raking up oil on the beach and picking it up with shovels. And if I misled you on that point, it was not intentional.
Do you have any idea when that might begin?
Yes, I think it will start in a couple of days, 2 or 3 days.
And what is the process?
We will put people on the beach, and they will continue to skim the free oil that's on the water. And then they will, once you've got all the free oil that's off the water, that's on the water, you might as well get it all off, because if you don't, tide just brushes it back on the sand or in the rocks. So we'll get it all the free oil off that's contained in the bays, and then we will begin to clean the sand and clean the rocks.
Are the 40 vessels that you have out there now, are those the 40? Are those 40 Exxon fishing vessels, or those 40 vessels operated by fishermen independent of Exxon?
It's under our contract.
I'm just trying to get the number.
They're all under the Exxon contract.
Okay.
Mr. Green, I said you had more people on your payroll than you knew what to do with, and you sent out a boat, the Glacier Queen, that didn't do much. Why aren't there any people on beaches cleaning up the oil?
Because the oil has not gotten on the beach as fast as we thought it was going to yesterday, and we're concentrating on trying to get all the free oil off the water before we start the beach cleanup. It doesn't help to clean a section of beach and then have oil come back and dirty it and you clean it again. We want to clean it one time only.
You couldn't clean the oil off the beach before. Can you do it now? Or clean the oil off the water before. Are you going to be able to do it now before it all gets on the beach?
We will get some of it, and some of it will get on the beach. We will get as much of it as we humanly can get.
How do you predict that would happen?
We will, as soon as it comes on shore, we kind of predict it would be there this, but as soon as it's all, we can get to it. And we're skimming out away from shore also as fast as we can. So every bit that we get out there doesn't get in the bays. Every bit we get in the bay doesn't get on the beach.
So a question from Mr. Singer, please. Sir, as president of Exxon USA...
Stevens, Bill Stevens.
I'm sorry. I've been here too long. From what you now know, sir, how would you rate your company's response to this spill and cleanup in lieu of what you said you would do in the contingency plan?
The contingency plan I believe you're speaking of is the that pursuant to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act. Basically, it's the Alyeska oil spill contingency plan, which consisted of two parts. The first, immediate response by the Alyeska men, materials, and equipment in the area, and then secondly, on a spill of this magnitude in Prince William Sound, and this was one of the scenarios that was envisioned, a secondary response almost exactly the way it's happened here in terms of equipment being marshaled from all over the U.S. and so on. It's the second phase of the response that Exxon has done and managed, if you will. And my feeling, again, having spent time with this right from the very first, is that our response has been timely and full as has been humanly possible. And I'd like to take that one step further with respect to the questions on cleanup and say that today I assured Senator Murkowski that when we got the beach clean, he would be satisfied with it. That's our intention.
Mr. Stevens, quick question. Former Interior Secretary Walter Hickel said today that if the industry had spent the money on capital equipment and expertise present here at Valdez, it would have been a fraction of the cost you're facing now. In retrospect, does the oil industry and Exxon in particular, is it giving any thought to having on site the thousands of feet of boom that you would need in a situation like this, the many more skimmers, the other technology that would be required to respond immediately?
This incident should never have happened. And it was a, in my view, a human failing that led to it. Now that it has happened, it's incumbent on us as an industry, and I think government agencies as well, to profit to the maximum extent from the experience. And certainly, as I referred to in my earlier comments, we will be going back and relooking at the contingency plans, and I would say very probably, not only here in Valdez, but more broadly. So where that will take us, I think it's premature to comment, but generally, we'll certainly have to do some reconsideration.
Now, second, you seem to refer to ANWR somewhat indirectly. Maybe I'm reaching there, but talking about how this should not be viewed as a general indictment of the industry and its ability to operate in sensitive environments. Do you think this is a major setback for ANWR and for the industry in that regard?
That question is probably better asked in Washington. But certainly, it's easy to say it's not going to help, and it will cause and raise a large number of questions. I'm confident that the industry will come forward and deal with those on a specific basis. But in terms of exactly what impact it's going to have, the political judgment, if you will, I'm not in a position to comment. I would make one additional comment, though. I was quite encouraged the other evening on a fairly extensive review that the governor, Steve Cooper, gave, in which he came out fairly forthrightly for a continued need to pursue broadly the development of resources in areas such as ANWR, even in spite of this incident. Yes.
Fishermen claim that they have purchased $100,000 worth of boom equipment from a warehouse in Seattle at a time when, again, they say Exxon claims it's been unable to find enough equipment to ship up here. First of all, is that true to your knowledge? Are you still having equipment problems? And secondly, is it appropriate that the fishermen are spending their own money on this kind of equipment?
I really don't know. We have mobilized all the boom from all the stockpiles that we can. I recognize that what we need is 18-inch boom. That's open water boom. There are a lot of other different types of boom. One is a sorbent boom that you lay along the beach to try to start cleanup. And in fact, we have about 20,000 feet of that. I have no knowledge of the particular instance you're talking about.
Is it appropriate, though, that fishermen are spending their own money on that kind of equipment?
Whatever they spend in the process of helping with the recovery, if it is their money, it'll certainly be reimbursed. And I don't have any knowledge of the issue.
Can I ask you a question about dispersants?
Yes.
Did I understand you to say that you're not intending to use dispersants unless there's more oil that comes and spills out of the ship?
Yeah, the oil that's been on the water since the incident is now so emulsified that there just isn't a way at this point. We thought we might have had a chance very early this morning, and we requested permission to use dispersant in two general areas off of Knight Island. We requested that last night. It was still under discussion about noontime, and we felt that at that point we had really crossed. Even if we started first thing this morning, we probably had a 10% chance or less of being effective. And of course, that's a time-dependent situation. So right now, we think that all of the oil that's on the water is so heavily emulsified that it's no longer amenable to a dispersing activity. We're having trouble even igniting it at this point. We thought we'd start a major burn this morning, but we were not able to ignite all of the oil slick that we had accumulated.
But again, you might reconsider that if more oil came out of the ship.
Oh yeah, we're holding the two planes and all that dispersant at the ready, and if we have any type of release, we have the authority for anything that moves into Zone 1 to use dispersant. That's from the on-scene commander through the RRT. So right now the dispersant planes and the dispersant are just a reserve mechanism to make sure that if we do get a release of new oil from the vessel, that we're able to get out very, very quickly.
Thank you very much. Question for Mr. Stevens, please. Can you please give us the feeling of Secretary Skinner and the rest of the team in terms of a federal response possibility in helping with the spill?
Well, we were one of a number of groups, I judge, that the Secretary and his party interviewed. Our participation in that, Frank's and my own, was more in terms of responding to their questions. They were very interested in a briefing on the situation, both past and present. It was factual. I don't think I have any feel, and to the extent that I do, it would be inappropriate for me to make any comment.
You're waiting for them to say it from Washington tomorrow.
How much? That's my understanding of what they're going to do. I believe they said they were going to report to the President early tomorrow morning.
How much more would it have cost to build the Valdez with a double hull? And whose call was it to build it with a single hull? And would that have made any difference in this particular case, if you can assess that at this point?
We started from the original design as a single hull tanker. And we'll have to await a full assessment of the damage to really understand whether a double hull would have made any difference. Some of those holes are extremely large, 20 feet by 15 feet, and the indent is so great that I doubt that it would have made a difference, but I can't make a statement fully until we get a real good assessment of the damage.
Mr. Rossi,
yes.
I know that you're focusing on the main task ahead of you, but I imagine you're making mental notes as you go along as to things that you might recommend next time this happens to somebody.
Yeah, I have hundreds of questions stored in the back of my mind. Many other same ones that you are.
Come to even any tentative conclusions or thoughts about what it was that kept you from deploying the dispersants and the other things you wanted to deploy in those first 3 days before the weather got bad?
I have a very detailed log, but I really don't want to engage in that, and I'll tell you why. It is so important that we maintain the kind of momentum and coordination that we've built up. There ain't no way I'm going to engage in finger pointing or backbiting while I'm still struggling with one of the biggest disasters that I could ever imagine. So I'm not going to engage. I know a lot of stones have been thrown. I'm not going to throw any. There will be a time when we'll review the total record, and we have a very careful record of all of our requests, all of our actions, all of our meetings. But no way I'm going to engage in it now.
What zones did you want to use the dispersion in when you asked for this latest permission? What zones were those?
It was a... you mean last night? It was an area just to the northwest and east of the upper part of Knight Island.
Yes, sir. One or two or three? You know what
he was on three, and that's why it really took a lot of discussion.
You were talking a minute ago, and you said that it doesn't look like you're going to be able to use dispersants anymore. You said the oil's too emulsified to burn. We were told earlier that at this point it's not really going to be possible to skim up a great deal of the oil. What are you going to do with it?
You know, from the beginning, I've tried to get people to understand that the mechanical cleanup is a very, very slow process. And I know everyone is anxious to see the oil removed from the water, but that is going to be one very slow process. Actually, the situation we have now with very light winds is the worst possible thing we could have, because we just have the water kind of, the oil and the mousse just sort of moving around out there. Probably the best thing at this point would be to see a strong wind move it down that channel. We are concentrating all of our efforts at protecting those very very critical areas. We're now beginning to boom some of the smaller estuaries, or will be, and then we'll be moving in those small skimmers. We then need to follow with beach teams, and you know, everyone is frustrated at not seeing beach cleanup going on, but all the beaches are still being impacted. And we dispatched a number of work crews yesterday, and they really weren't able to begin work. And those are the crews that somebody said we had people out there, they weren't doing anything. The other thing we're doing right now, and we need to do it very carefully because there's a lot of state approvals and federal approvals needed, but we're planning base camps. We're siting base camps in a couple different places, and those base camps will be the site from which we'll begin the beach cleanup.
Let's take some questions on this side.
Mr. Stevens, I'm sure you're aware of the economy in Alaska for the last 3 or 4 years. We were told this morning that approximately 300 people were hired by VECO, which is a non-union company, and approximately 100 people were hired by Norcom, which is a union company. Does this indicate any kind of union or anti-union violence on the part of Exxon?
No, just the contrary. We thought we should spread it around, and we did that from the beginning.
Mr. Rossi, what percentage of the spill is now what's known as mousse? And is mousse, can you clean it in any way or disperse it in any way, or are you only left with the option of allowing it to impact?
The best assessment we can make of the 240,000 barrels that was released to the Prince William Sound, somewhere in the league of 70,000 to 115,000 barrels has degraded naturally, most of it through vaporization. What is remaining is largely in two forms, primarily this heavy mousse. There also still is some light sheen in different areas. The heavy mousse is really a oily water emulsification, and that it gets a larger water content as time goes on. Right now it has a very significant water content to it, and that's why we could not ignite it today, although we had intentionally created a significant area that we had entrapped using fire booms, and we hoped to ignite. We were not able to do that. We've changed our operations to a couple sites that may give us a better chance. So we're going to continue.
Can you remove it in any method?
We cannot disperse it.
And you can't mechanically remove it?
Oh, we can mechanically remove it. It's just a very slow process. We can pick it up. We can skim a moose.
Now, Mr. Goodman, what has he told you in terms of projections of how much of that moose, which is the difference between 150,000, which you say is evaporated?
115 at most.
150. How much of that is going to make its way past all the islands and out into the Gulf? Have you been given projections?
No, we don't have projections because it depends totally on the wind direction, wind velocity. I think NOAA is doing a number of studies to come up with different scenarios, but it really is going to depend upon the interaction of the currents and the wind and the strength of the wind and the direction.
What you have, Frank, and are moving to try to minimize that is conditions you expect.
Yeah, what we're doing is beyond the highly motivated defensive operation of the most pristine areas and most productive areas, we are trapping in one of the large bays on Night Island. In other words, intentionally trying to shepherd the moose into that island where we have a large skimming operation going inlet. I'm sorry, not island, inlet, where we have a number of the skimmers concentrated, and trying to pick that up. We are also, by using booms, attempting to deflect the moose away from the shoreline in certain areas that we find very critical. And it's just going to continue that way with every effort being made to skim as much of it as we can.
There's a gentleman right back there that's trying to ask a question.
Yeah, could I ask him from this side of the room,
your primary chemicals in disbursement and what kind of volume you would be talking?
We went through that two or three press conferences. Right now it's not an issue because we are not going to be using dispersant.
No answer.
Well, listen, it's... Conferences. Right now it's not an issue because we are not going to be using dispersant.
No answer.
It's been answered.
It's an Exxon manufactured chemical called Corexit 9527.
Mr. Stevens, since your company has assured us that you did your best and you do not accept any grave criticisms of your methods, and since you've said it's very difficult and very slow, and you said that the weather didn't cooperate, isn't the inevitable conclusion, therefore, that in incidents like this there's very little that oil companies can do, and therefore a whole consideration is needed about this kind of delivery of oil, especially in view of the Anwar plans to put its oil through the Alaska pipeline?
Through a whole chain of premises to that question that I don't agree with. And by the time you got there, I had lost track of the question. It was more in the form of a speech. If you would, ask the question.
I was, in fact, quoting back to the points that have been made to us in the last three or four days about the fine performance of your company. Comments that you've just...
Well, let me say one thing. Well, I never said, never intended to say, that we didn't accept criticism, and I never said, and I don't intend to say, that we never make mistakes. Well, obviously, that would be foolish on my part.
What was the question? Well, various criticisms have been made, have been rebutted by your corporation. And I'm saying, and you reiterate that you have done, in fact, the best job that it was possible to do, given that point.
No, I was asked for my view of our performance, and I gave my view. I didn't say that there wasn't room for criticism or that other people hadn't criticized and that we wouldn't accept that. But again, the question I asked was not the one you referenced.
You have done pretty much as best a job as could have been done, and the oil is still here and very little has been removed. Doesn't that give us cause for reconsideration of the entire process?
Well, Frank, you said this morning when I arrived, welcome to day six. Would you expect, with a spill of this magnitude, day six to have completely handled the whole matter? Anywhere in the world, any situation,
It's going to take a little while to handle the problem, but again, one of my purposes is to assure that we will, yes.
Given what's occurred here, I don't think it can be seen as anything but an indictment of the oil company's ability to handle a case like this. So given that, I think the burden of proof is upon you to prove to the American public that you deserve to be able to operate in a place like this. So what specifically do you plan to do for the future to assure that and to give that confidence?
Well, I think I've already commented on that in a couple of respects. One, we will make every attempt to assure that we benefit from the lessons of this incident. We'll continue to work to improve our base business. Again, I caught that record in terms of steady improvement.
What specifically with regard to places like Bristol Bay, offshore California coast, and back here?
Well, again, I can't comment on a specific. I can comment on the generality. There are too many specifics with regard to a specific for me to comment. Yes.
How many oil spill experts does Exxon have on its payroll?
We have
the question is pretty fuzzy as to what an expert is.
Probably be well if you define what you mean by an expert. Expert in what phase? I mean, in dispersal?
Well, why would you have an expert on your staff? Let's start with that. Do you
not? We have the Exxon response team in the organization that is outlined for that response, numbers about 50 positions.
Now, is that before the spill?
I'm talking about, yes, we have, for the past 10 years, have had in place a response organization. That response organization has about 50 positions in it, and we have basically three people for each of those positions to allow us to be able to respond, even though people may be on vacation or out. And what we do, we also have to provide for relief. Now, of those, in all of those 50 positions, we have people trained to do certain functions. Some are in logistics, some are in beach cleanup, some are in dispersant, some are in mechanical cleanup. Now, those people are trained in all of those positions. So I would call them, in my definition, they are experts in that piece of it. Now, what we also have on call to us is a number of non-Exxon experts that we can mobilize very quickly. And that's a large portion of the 96 non-Exxon people that we have contracted to us working at that response center. That organization that we put in place starting Friday night goes back to a lot of study and preparation conceptually, organizationally, it started about 10 years ago.
Richard Golob is reporting that 4 and 5 years ago, 9 experts left. They were offered early retirement. Is that correct?
I couldn't comment, but you know, we started 10 years ago. I can't count them. I don't know that. We started 10 years ago. Now, let me finish. We started 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we identified these experts. Now, right now, all those people that we put in place are 10 years older than when we first identified them. I imagine that, or certainly, when we identified them 10 years ago, they were very experienced people. They were the best we can get our hands on. I imagine that a certain percentage of them were 50 years plus at the time we identified them and are now 60 years plus and just retired. So if a certain amount of people retired, I would say that's probably not true.
Let me just make one additional comment to that. The numbers of people and sort of planning, if you will, contingency plan in terms of people and expertise, he was quoting, is company-wide, not just shipping. And these are interfunctional, that is, from various branches of our company. And of course, in specialty areas, we have call on our research companies, which have a good deal of expertise in some of the narrow areas having to do with fate and effects of oil and water and so on as well.
There's one other point we ought to add, too. When someone takes early retirement who is an expert, he then becomes a consultant, and we hire him anyway. And we have some of those up here.
Were those 9 who left 4 years ago, were they replaced? Or were those positions dropped?
They were replaced as they were needed. You know, when you downsize an organization, you don't replace a number for another.
Yes, they were replaced. Dr. Lindblom is one of those gentlemen who retired. He was on in the first group that returned. So we did not lose expertise that was not replaced. That team was up and running and never was not up and running. Yes, ma'am. I recognize you from day one.
We're charter boat operators in Princeton Sound. We'd be very concerned about Princeton Sound and what's happening. And I do want to thank you for your patience with all of us. But I have some questions. And the gentleman to my right has questions afterwards.
Yes.
I've got the contingency plan, and looking at your contingency for this spill-up,
my contingency plan, Exxon Shipping, is three binders this thick.
All right. Spill cleanup on shorelines. We're, of course, particularly concerned about shorelines.
Yes.
We're intimately familiar with shorelines, because that might imply we went aground on them. We have not gone aground on any shorelines. We walk on the shorelines. Your contingency plan says most shoreline and beach areas should not require extensive cleanup unless there is a large volume of oil present in the area, a sensitive area is significantly affected, the economics or aesthetics of a place of residence, scenic beauty, or study area is affected, it acts as a source of continuing contamination. The decision to clean up a contaminated shoreline will be made by the terminal superintendent after consultation with the environmental supervisor, restoration supervisor, and appropriate advisors and government agencies. I'd like to know who's included in the appropriate advisors and if members of the charter boat industry and tourism industry, recreation industry could be included in that. And from our perspective, all of Prince William Sound is an unsurpassed scenic beauty.
I agree.
You have an incredibly difficult problem cleaning up
the
beaches.
The statement you read is for those spills, I'm sure it was minor spills, that are under Alyeska's control. Right now, this is under Exxon Shipping Company control. We intend to leave this place as close to what it was when the incident started. We are not going to spare any effort to clean up, and we are not going to identify any areas that aren't going to be cleaned up. You have my word for that. We are going to be here a long time. We're digging in. The cleanup is going to take a long time, and we're going to do it.
We appreciate that, but we also want to make sure that in the process of cleaning up, more damage is not done. We are very concerned about
chances
on the Chugach National Forest with sewage and garbage and human traffic on a very fragile ecosystem on shore.
Yes, and we have
that they
encouraged
will be housed on boats or ships.
We have encountered certainly that concern with the state agencies that we are working with. We are now planning for the beach cleanup. We just can't go in there. I know everyone in the press would like pictures of 100 people on the beach with shovels. That's not the way it's going to happen. In fact, you can probably stay through all the rest of this week. You won't see it happen. It's going to be a very carefully planned activity. The state agencies will be playing the major role in deciding where we site, how we address each specific beach area, each specific inlet. We may be allowed to do some things in one area that we wouldn't dare do in others. So just the siting alone of where we put a base camp, I think, is going to take days. And the reason it is not because we don't want to do it sooner, but because of the sensitivity that this lady explained. We're going to do this thing very, very carefully. It's going to be very, very well coordinated with the state agencies. We have that organization in place through this, the three-member steering committee and the operations coordination group, and those discussions of how we site, how we clean, where we go are already underway. It's going to be done very, very carefully.
Appreciate that very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Mr. Arlossi, thank you. There's a gentleman to my left with one more question here. Your spokesman, we work together here. Your spokesman, Mr. Cornett, used the figure of 240,000 barrels spilled in this spill for several days now. He mentioned this morning or made reference to that, the fact that indeed, as long as this ship is grounded on this reef, oil is leaking out of it.
No.
And at this moment, oil is still coming out of it. Doesn't that mean that our $240,000 figure is archaic at this point?
No, not at all. Not at all. We have a boom around the ship. We have one, and I believe perhaps two skimmers there, but the release from the ship has been almost insignificant. And in fact, it may be oil still entrapped under the hull. You know, maybe it's not 240,000, maybe it's 243,000. But if your question is an implication that it's now 500,000 or 400,000 or 300,000, it's absolutely not the case. Yes.
I'm not really speaking for myself here, but for probably a good portion of the people that are here in the room, I'm sure everyone would like to hear from you if you have an opinion or an idea of possibly a thought on whether or not your company will endorse a priority local hire of Alaskans that would like to help you clean this mess up.
Yeah.
We have been in that mode since about day two or three.
Yeah, I understand you have the magnitude of your problem is overwhelming. I feel bad for you in that area. However, there are a lot of naturally concerned local and statewide concern about this. There are people that are being brought in a technical advisory capacity, I'm sure, that can't be brought from anywhere else. But as you see by the concerned faces here that you have in front of you, there is a very large number of people that would be real happy to roll up their sleeves and go to work with you. We understand the logistics of making a tactful approach and not having to try to lift the same load twice. I think that if you people had any kind of a statement or policy that would let these other people feel a little better about being Alaskans, that they'd sure be glad to get in there and help you.
As I landed at the Anchorage Airport last night and drove into the hotel quite late, the tail end of the Cordova town meeting was going on, and I was struck, perhaps touched, by people's desire to want to help, people's desire to want to do something. The short answer to your question is yes, we do.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question. You mentioned early that you wanted to look beyond this incident to with respect to our energy resources and to continue improving our standard of living. And the question I have has to do with our standard of living on the planet and Exxon's responsibility toward the effect of oil on the planet Earth with regard to global warming. What is your responsibility and what responsibility are you taking for looking to alternative sources of energy and ways to get off of the oil, I guess, fix that this nation is on? I realize that you're a profit-making company, and I realize that your product is oil, but what responsibility do you have towards improving the standard of living when everything that oil does is taking away from our standard of living, which is our quality of life?
Well, of course, there's some of these impacts of energy use that at this point in time, I think there's still a large number of questions as to exactly why some of the trends you mentioned are occurring or just what the meaning of them is. But let me reply more broadly, if I might. The company, me, the other employees of Exxon are citizens here, and we value pristine environments every bit as much as Alaskans. We may not have quite the beauty you have in the coastal area of Texas, but where it comes to assuring that as a responsible corporate citizen, we are conducting ourselves in a way so as to not present a conflict between the environment, again, the place where we all live, and our nation's need for energy, that's an area where we spend a good deal of time and work hard in, and I'm satisfied that we'll continue, not we as a company, but we as a nation, to find ways to make those trade-offs in a responsible fashion without having to sacrifice either.
Mr. Stevens, one question about
Yes, you've been very patient.
Earlier we were talking about dispersants, and Mr. Urassi, I believe, said that the decision to use dispersants, or at least the idea of using dispersants right now, seemed to be a dead issue. But you were leaving that open for possible use with any leaking oil that might come out of the tanker. Has your decision at this point not to use any more dispersants have anything to do with any of your previous test results or uses?
No, none at all. Quite the contrary. My understanding, without being a dispersant, not person, expert, is that all of the tests, the understanding of the impact of dispersants in water, so forth and so on, are several years old. I mean, they're not of recent vintage, and the tests that have been done more recently just look at the effect on this spill, not in terms of the effect of dispersants. So no, it's just purely and simply, I think Frank explained it quite well, the situation with respect to the oil itself, i.e. it's in a stable emulsion and dispersants don't help.
The decision to not move any further with dispersant was one that I took at noon today. Remember, I said we had initiated that request at 9 o'clock last night. By noon today, I felt that we had sufficiently lost that window, that dispersant had such a low chance of being successful on that what we now have very highly emulsified oily water mixture, that it was not it made no sense to continue to press and have people discuss it. It at this point it's a non-issue on the old oil.
But have you had any problems with trying to use it on this spill up to today? And has
we have a very